like SOAP toolkits for various kind of things. And then there was like small updates on some other kind of some other documents. So that's all. So the IANA registry is the important thing. So those of you who write documents, please make sure that you only register at enum services what actually is an enum service. And you will, and the documents, and that the document, the IANA registry will be updated, but not the documents that the IANA registry reference. Thank you.
The next speaker is Jim Reid on UK plus 44.
F4, isn't it?
F5.
Full screen?
F5.
F5.
I think. No. No. Oh, it's
Microsoft. Thank you. Just very quick overview, just to bring everyone up to speed of what's been happening in the UK since the last time we met, and there's an interesting idea. Click, come on. Why is this thing not giving me? I'll try this. Okay. In reverse order, or increasing in interest, first of all is block registrations. We think we've found a way of solving the chicken egg problem of getting registrations into the tree and encouraging uptake of applications. Some other progress or potential progress has been made on governance issues in the UK and the outcome of the consultation exercise. So taking these in reverse order, and this, oh, Windows, I hate it. Right, the consultation exercise that the government had last year, has now been analysed by the civil service and crunched away, and the results have been sent to the minister in the Department of Trade and Industry that's responsible for telecommunications. That's the good news. The bad news is that we're now in a black hole because nothing's going to happen until after the election, which is taking place today, because we don't know who the minister is going to be, because there could be a change of government, and we don't know, even if the current government comes back, if the same minister will be in post after the new after the election. So until we find the outcome of that, which is probably going to be a couple of weeks, we don't know how soon the government is going to sign off on this analysis of the consultation exercise, but no particular problem is expected there. One of the problems that we've found, and which is pretty much the case for all the other public enum trees, is that it's very, very sparsely populated. And because it's very sparsely populated, nobody is really doing enum lookups, because the chances of getting a meaningful result back is very low. And of course that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, that because there are very few enum aware software, pieces of software out there and applications, there's not much of an incentive for people to register their domain names under the enum tree. Another instance that we have to deal with is that the UK Enum Group needs cash to do some of the things that it has to do, for example, legal work, setting up companies and all the rest of it. So we have to find some way of breaking that problem too. So we've come up with this idea of what we call bulk registrations. And the initial proposal for this scheme was to deal with virgin number blocks that would be assigned by the regulator to new operators, essentially operators that are doing voice over IP. So the idea we would do is take the whole block of numbers, let's say 10,000 numbers in the range, and put entries for those directly into the Tier 1 zone file to NAPTR records. So we initially proposed this idea, and we then took it back to the group as a whole. The existing telcos said, hey, wait a minute, we would like to do this for our existing number ranges too. So I have to go back and revisit this document, come up with a scheme which would work for them as well. Now, the authentication for that in the first instance would be based on the regulator's database, because we should in principle be able to find out from that database, which is public, which number ranges have been assigned to which particular telco operators. So what we would do in this particular scheme is that, assuming it went ahead, we would enter a tel URI and a SIP URI for each number. So there would be two NAPTR records for each number in the number block, The Telluride would point at the corresponding number that was being queried for, and there would be a SIP URI pointing at the appropriate SIP gateway for the telco or the communications service provider. And we also thought that maybe if this scheme has got some value, we might consider adding other NAPTA records later, say, for example, for an MMS gateway or an SMS gateway service or something like that. But the important point is that as this scheme gets started, there is no delegation of those numbers. And what would then happen is that whenever the number, an individual number, was assigned to an end customer of the telco, the customer would then tell the end customer, this data is in the public ENAM tree, would you like to get the number delegated, and then play with the NAPTA records to your heart's content and do whatever else you like. And what we'd like to suggest is that the CSPs and telcos participating in this scheme would tell us that whenever the number was ported from one telco to another, in actual fact that idea has also got attractions for some of the existing number ranges that are in use by incumbent telcos. Customers obviously are going to get told whenever the number is activated that it's in the public ENAM tree, and of course then the customer can get it delegated to them. And hopefully what we could then do is persuade the telcos that are providing this functionality to provide online authentication and validation of the end users. So this would almost be like the balancing act, that in exchange for getting these NAPTA records into the public ENAM tree, they provide some kind of online authentication and validation scheme. Help keep the cost down. And I keep hitting the wrong button in this Windows. Yep. So what we think we can do then is we'll get large amounts of data in the public tree, and also encourage ENAM-aware applications and solutions to come forward, and obviously we can get money in for the UK ENAM group because we can actually charge the telcos money for these block registrations. And the sort of thing we could see having value there would be is for authentication of inbound VoIP traffic, so that whenever a number is presented to the SIP gateway or the SIP proxy, the SIP proxy can do a lookup at the public ENAM tree for that, and if it gets an answer back, then there's a reasonable degree of trust that maybe that caller ID number that's been presented is meaningful and sensible and can be trusted for some loose definition of the term trust. So that's some potential value, which would actually is why we see that there's a use for it. Now, the question some of you might be asking is, why are we considering putting in a SIP URI and a TEL URI? Well, the reason for putting the TEL URI is that we could well have ENAM-aware applications that don't understand SIP. Highly unlikely, but we're working on the assumption that if an application comes along, does an ENAM lookup, can't cope with a SIP URL or whatever else it is, it can quite simply dump the call in the PSTN, and it knows how to dump the call on the PSTN. And obviously there's some open issues there with things like the number portability process. We thought there were some concerns about privacy and data protection, but at the last meeting with us to discuss, there was a representative of the regulator there and also a representative of the government, and they seemed fairly relaxed about the whole thing. We're not really disclosing personal information, so it doesn't seem to violate the basic principle of opt-in. But at least that was what they were saying the last time we spoke to them about it. And obviously there's going to have to be some kind of legal framework, memorandum of understanding or something like that, if this scheme goes ahead. Finally, on the governance side of things, I think we're beginning to see some light at the end of the tunnel, and I hope it's not an oncoming train. There's been discussion for a while about how we try to create some kind of entity in the UK that represents the UK ENAM consortium or the people that are interested in it. The UK ENAM group has no legal status, so we need to create some kind of legal personality for it. So I've come up with an idea, which is we'll just create a company, limited by guarantee, that's going to have a charter and model memorandums of articles broadly similar to those that are used by Nominet, the UK top-level domain registry. And if we get a rough idea of consensus on this, that the idea is acceptable, I think we could get this underway fairly soon. By doing it this way, essentially what I'm saying is, here is a set of documents to define this legal entity. Do you, all the other participants in the UK ENAM group, agree to this, yes or no? It's not going to have all the lawyers from British Telecom and Cable and Wireless and Vodafone arguing over every clause and sub-clause and paragraph of any kind of legal document, because that would just take forever. And we already went through all that pain and agony when we set up the original MOU for the trial a couple of years ago. And that's my last slide, so I'll take questions if there are any.
From Nicola.T. You mentioned putting in SIP URIs. Who's providing the gateways for accepting the SIP calls?
This would be by the telco that owns the number block.
Is there any word on that, if they're going to do that?
Sorry, if there's any...
Any telco... sucks here. Is there any telco promising to do that and accepting calls, really do that?
Well, we think so, yes. Some of these telcos have said it's a good idea. Well, now, this is the thing. They say it's a good idea, this sounds a great idea. In principle, where it will turn out in practice, I don't know. We'll have to try it and see.
Our next speaker is Otmar Lendl from Enum AT. He'll be discussing progress within Austria, plus 43. You want to hear?
So hello, I'm trying to give you an update on the Austrian side, plus 43. In two aspects. First, I'm going to talk about the validation scheme we have in production. And later then, I'm going to talk about the new numbering range, 780 for Enum-driven voice over IP and other services. But first, validation. I'm going to talk a bit about what happened between since the last time I was talking to you. Some time ago, we talked about some nice schemes, and I want to give you an update on how things progressed on that one, and what changed, and what solution we have in place now to do the validation. Quick overview of what you're talking about. The Enum domain is an attribute to the normal telephone number, so the ownership of the Enum domain should always follow the ownership of the telephone number. We have to check this first on the initial delegation, and then we have to make sure that it stays in sync over the lifetime of a number and the domain. Back at RIPE 45, some time ago, I've been talking about a scheme which we tried to implement in Austria. The main idea was that we want to have online synchronous validation. The idea was that most of the telcos know their customers. Most of the telcos give username and password to the customers for our online self-service portals. And if we can use that login information and build some kind of cross-domain authentication scheme, like, for example, with Radius, then we have a way to automatically validate the ownership of numbers across different players. We propose to have one trusted third party as the central nexus of the system, which then can say, okay, that request has passed to my system, everything's okay, and can now sign, yeah, this validation has succeeded, everything is fine. Well, that was a theory. In practice, we found out that our local incumbent wasn't really warming up to the idea. The main idea is that their reasoning was that if they gonna do for their own customers some kind of validation scheme, in this central system idea, then everybody else can use their work. And they had this kind of idea like, why should we help somebody else to enable Enum so that we will lose our termination fees and call minutes. So they didn't really like the idea. On the second hand, the regulator said, hands off, we weren't going to force anybody to cooperate. So once the incumbent said, we're going to do that, and the regulator said, we ain't going to force them to do it. Well, too bad. Next point is that if the registrar and the telco is in fact one and the same person, then having to talk via a third party might not be the optimal and simplest way of doing things. But we had our start
date in December last year, so we needed something to get up the ground, to get something up and running, even if it's not perfect, but get it up and running. So the requirements changed a bit. We wanted to be able to cope with all possible role settings, whether the registrar and the telco and some validation entity are separate, or if they are together in one person, or if, for example, there's some mixture between external validation by telco and registrar are the same person. We still want to keep the possibility to audit the system, so that when anything goes wrong, we can put our finger on it. Hey, you made the mistake. So it was it's a difference to some other proposals floating around. We don't just have the registrar say, yeah, flag, validation occurred. We want somebody to really be liable for that and to be able to afterwards say, yeah, you signed this thing, you're responsible. So overall, our motto was make the baby steps possible and make a fully automatic system possible if players decide to cooperate later on. So we got rid of the central trusted third party, and we no longer require cooperation between all players. It's if they want to, fine, it helps, but we don't require it anymore. So, as we don't have this single trusted third party, we have multiple validation entities. I think that term has popped up in slides from the UK and other countries, so it's fine to see how different countries come to similar solutions here. So, any registrar is now free to set up his own validation entity, and in our experience, this really happens. In terms of the concrete ways and steps to do validation, we don't care. We don't specify as a tier one registry how validation has to occur. We just give up, we just tell them you have to be able to reach a certain quality level. Your error probability has to be lower than some threshold. But we do not specify how this is achieved. Neither do we specify any protocol between other players in the system. We only specify the protocol how the registrar is giving the validation information to us as a tier one service in Austria. So we define how the validation results are presented, how they're communicated. We define a trust model, who's going to be responsible for what, and in some all the information, keeping track on what methods have been used to validate customers. So from our old model, which had the tier one on the left, then multiple registrars, then a trusted third party as a one single entity who talks, who makes the connection between telcos or other validation engines to registrars, we replaced that and said, okay, there can be more than one, and it's not possible to say these roles can collapse. We have one single company who's fulfilling all three roles. The validation token. Now, once a validation entity has done the validation, it has to somehow communicate to us as a central tier one, yeah, it did work, it worked out, we did validation according to that method, everything is fine, you can delegate the domain. But as you see here, the validation entities don't talk to the tier one registry. All communication is passed via the registrars. In order to be able to pass the thrust over the communication path, the user signed document. So we use a cryptographic signature on an XML document to make sure that this validation information survive the transfer via the registrar untampered with. Okay, what does our token contain? We have acquired fields, of course, the number, for which registrar was the validation, who did the validation, which method was used, times and serial number there, and timestamps, like this validation was performed at this date and expires at half year or 2 years or whatever in the future, depending on the number range, whatever. The validation entity is free to set the expired date on the token. And once the token expires, the delegation is revoked on the T1. Then there are optional fields like subscriber name, address, all the typical person object data, and even space for some validation entity-specific information like travel ticket IDs and whatever they might use there. Yeah, and then there is the signature, which is an XML SIG signature, which is a standard from the W3C, as far as I know. And we use X509 certs, but without an MPKI system. We have defined a schema, so the syntax of the token can be checked automatically. And it works quite nicely within the EPP schema. We have expanded the default XML scheme, which is used for the registry interaction, to include the XML scheme for the token. So any delegation request containing a token can be automatically checked on syntactic correctness. We've submitted a draft to the ITF, which specifies this token. And an implementation of this thing is available on our website as a Perl module. We've done this all for the purpose of enum, but when thinking it through, the problem of having to authenticate some rights for a domain name is not unique to enum. For example, specialized TLDs with rules on who can own a domain there might also use the same model. If somebody else checks, hey, you're allowed to have a domain under .museum or whatever, then this validation system could create a token there and pass it to the registry. It could be helpful for sunrise phases like .eu now, where somebody has to do the trademark check and whatever before a domain delegation request can be submitted to the registry. That would be an idea here. Well, leaving the pure DNS space, it could be useful for number portability issues and procedures, or even for number assignment. If, for example, the local numbering authority delegates a number to a company, for example, a corporate network number, they might issue tokens so that the company can prove to all other carriers, yeah, here I am, I'm the owner of this number. What do we have? We have in production registrars who create tokens based on their in-house validation systems. On one example, some kind of telephony provider ports numbers into his network, and the same procedures he's using for validating this porting is then used to create tokens because he has to check the ownership rights of the number. And our own portal uses two methods. One is SMS loops to create tokens, or we've built one validation entity based on the manual process with fax and whatever stuff, which is based on the RT extension. Probably some of you might know the RTIR, the RT for instance response. So we built some kind of travel ticketing system to manually validate numbers based on facts and whatever stuff. But in the future, all the fancy cross-domain authentication methods are still possible. So once some telco allows us to query their database, then we can do all the stuff, all the nice things we dreamed about 2 years ago. This is not a proposal. This is production. We are up and running since last December. So the system is working. And by now we have 3 independent implementations of the token generation. One from us in Perl, one from somebody who built our portal in Java, and the third one I think is in C++. Okay, that's the first part of my presentations. Any questions on the validation?
Robert Schaefer, MCI. The question is there a fundamental stake in the ground that's been placed that validation needs to exist, and is it the registrar's responsibility?
In Austria, our local numbering authority and regulator said you have to ensure that this works. And in the contract from the government to us, giving us the operational responsibility for 3.4.E164.APA, this contract says you have to make sure that the error rate is smaller than whatever percent. So we are passing down these requirements to our registrars, which if they do it themselves, okay, but they can pass it on to some external company. But there is an official contractual obligation to make sure this happens.
Great, thanks.
Neil O'Reilly, University College, Dublin. In the past, you Austrians have been very friendly in making your developments available for other people to piggyback on. Is this still the case with the validation plugins?
The code for the validation token generation and checking is part of our client toolkit, which is basically open for everybody. Just register on our website, www.enum.at, and you get access to our documents and code, so you can get that one.
That's very nice.
And if you and even the validation portal, which I wrote as an adaption of the RT system, well, that's a bit rough edges there, but if you want to see that one, come to me.
Andy Newton, VeriSign. There was at the Enum working group at the last IETF, there was a validation document accepted as, I think, was it BCP? And is this compatible with that, or is this a completely different schema?
As far as I know, there was a talk from Ben Hühnereisen from Switzerland on that.
Yeah, I believe it was accepted as a working group, IETF, you know, working group document.
We missed the last IETF in America, but we're going to be in Paris and do an update on our IT draft, our internet draft, and we try to get more active in the IETF space again.
So is your plan then to provide compatibility with whatever the outcome of that document is?
Yes.
Okay.
Or to be exact, you want to drive the document. Any more on validation? Stefan?
Stefan Hagnell, how is the recurring validation made?
Once again, the actual method of recurring validation, we don't care. We just define the protocol between the registrar and the and us. In terms of recurring validation, every token has a lifetime. And once it expires, the domain is gone. So we have an option in our EPP interface to tell the registry, here's a new token, which hopefully has a longer lifetime than the last one. But how this token is generated and whatever the validation entity did to ensure that it's okay, different problem space. Okay, second talk for me. In Austria, we got a new numbering range for Enum and Voice over IP or other services in the convergence between PSTN and the internet. This is a bit tricky. Please ask if there are any questions. It took us a long time to get our head around it, so I don't expect you to have this instant flash of enlightenment here. Please ask. Quick summary. In the numbering range plus 43780, the following rules are in place now. The inner delegation is a prerequisite for the number assignment, not the other way around. The number allocation procedure is different. It's neither a typical block assignment nor the typical Austrian variant of the individual number assignment, which is, for example, in place for free phone numbers or corporate network numbers. The destination of the call must be on the internet. And the destination URI has to be specified within the Enum DNS. Fourth part is every telco is allowed to bypass the normal SS7 interconnect by terminating directly via IP. Okay, in detail, to get numbers. And to get numbers in this case means numbers are given to communication service providers. They are not given by the regulator to the end user. They are given to the communication service provider, just like block allocation. But to get a number there as a CSP, as a communication service provider, you have to fulfill the following requirements. You have to offer a communication service based on Enum. You can't just use this new number as an alias for a geographic number. The endpoint has to be reachable via the internet. And the routing is done via Enum. You can't use some private database to translate a number to a CPRI. It has to be the public Enum DNS. And the whole thing is not restricted to voice calls. The numbering range is open to all registered communication service providers in Austria, which don't really have to be Austrian. In the old style number assignment, you either have, in Austria at least, you have either block assignment where the numbering authority gives a whole block of numbers to a carrier, and the carrier then gives individual number to his customers. Or the other way in the old system is to go directly to the number authority and say, I want to have this free phone number, please give it to me. And they get some nice paper with a stamp and whatever on it. Here's your number. In the old style, you first have to get a number, and then you can get the domain. Here, it's all the way around. You can get first the Enum domain, and once you can show the numbering authority, here is the Enum domain for me, then you can get the official assignment of a number to your company. So, numbers are still assigned to telcos, to CSPs, kind of like blocks, but they're not really blocks. There's just a set of numbers within the whole numbering range. It's not like from 0 to 5,000. No. It's just like domains. But in order to get a number officially, you have to provide a gateway.
What kind of gateway?
depends. If you say I'm going to do a service, as you say, you have to provide a communication service based on enum. So if you tell the regulator I'm going to do voice, then your gateway has to do at least voice. So in our, as far as it comes on the now, it's at least SIP and voice calls. About call routing. In Austria, we don't have any automatic routing between telcos. There's no BGP in the voice sector. Everything is hand-maintained block routing. Stone Age, but telcos. And furthermore, in Austria, there's no central database of active numbers and the current routing information. Like, for example, in America, you have Neustar is running this database which maps telephone numbers to line endpoints, whatever, it's over there. I don't know exactly. We don't have that in Austria. So the old style routing is the following. All telcos know who owns which blocks. And whenever they have a call to a number within a block, they route to the owner of the block. There are some exceptions for free phone numbers and similar, which are done via intelligent network routing. Another possibility is done with onward routing, which means call is delivered to the block owner, which then says, "Whoa, not me anymore, over there." I think you redirect is the correct translation into the IP space. 4780. If we start with just one communication service provider who gets numbers within those blocks, it's easy. This CSP himself has to have a gateway or has to have a contract with somebody who has a gateway, so he can terminate calls to the IP side via his gateway. And everybody else can use the old style routing because we know that telco has numbers in that range, so he can terminate calls to that numbering range and can use the normal SSL interconnect to pass the buck to him and pay termination fee. In the picture, on the left we have the old PSTN network with some clouds of different carriers. And once the first one on the top has numbers in 780, it has to have a gateway there. And for the gateway, using the public information in enum, it can distribute calls and terminate calls via the internet. Everybody else on the PSTN side can use the normal, typical SS7 interconnect to pass calls over and then route all the way around. But here's the big difference to the old side routing. If you see a lot of calls there, then the lower PSTN carrier will then say, "I'm paying termination fees to the other guy up there. Why don't I do just this? Build my own gateway. I don't have to pay termination fees anymore to the other carrier. I can do my own termination." And termination via IP, what's the price of a megabit right now? So we expect that maybe not in the first year or so, but if this system takes off, then it will be a good choice for various carriers to do their own gateway. And by the way, this is not restricted to Austria. So if we see a lot of calls coming, for example, from Germany to Austrian numbers in that range, then the German telco can do its own gateway. Everything is okay. What about porting? Porting is very, very trivial here. Porting is just changing the designation of the communication service provider ID within the registry. It has no impact on the routing in the PSDN. The routing in the PSDN is done on the whole 780 block. It doesn't matter who owns a singular number in this block. I, as the originating telco, can choose my gateway for the whole block, independently of who owns the individual number within that block. This is the big difference to typical voice over IP numbering ranges, where the owner of the number kind of decides which gateway will be used to terminate calls on the internet. Because all calls from the PSDN have to first go within the PSDN to his provider and then use that gateway. In 780, it's only the originating network who decides which gateway to use. So when I own a 780 number, then I can expect to have incoming calls from various different gateways. So once I change the ownership in the PSDN side of things to a different communication service provider, it doesn't affect the routing in the PSDN, because we don't use that information in any case. There's no impact on the routing by enum, because it's just a flag in the database who owns the number, which is the whole system just a way to keep sure that the old laws are fulfilled, because there has to be a CSP owning a number. You can't have numbers floating around without a CSP. And there's no impact on the number assignment paperwork. Porting is totally transparent here. What about tariffs? Calls to 0780 are Quellnetztarifiert, as the German word is, which means that the originating network can charge their customers whatever they want. And there are no official price ranges being defined. So it's supposed to be that the market decides, market forces then decide, well, if this telco charges too much for calls to 1780, customers will leave. What do we expect to happen? Our guess is, and we have pretty good indication that this is true, that we'll see tariffs somewhere between local and national calls, similar to the 1720, which is the Austrian-wide geographic portable number range, or corporate numbers. We think that once there are more than one gateway in the network, there will be competition between the gateways. If telco A and telco B both tell each other, all other telcos, hey, give me your 780 calls, I can terminate them. There's a competition on the interconnection fees, because both can terminate them. And as mentioned before, if some other telco, be it a mobile carrier, whoever sees a lot of calls to 780, he can just build his own gateway and terminate calls locally. Meaning, in the long term, we assume that tariffs will be similar to network internal calls, which right now is some in Austria in the range of one cent per minute. So that's our guess. And you can build a gateway taking one Cisco box and using some glue IT in front of it and behind of it. Building a gateway, it's rather simple. You can do it. We have a sampling implementation. Can be done. Simple. It's simple, so we guess that carriers will do that one and will use that one. Okay. Questions? Complete confusion, or everything's clear?
I think everything appears to be very clear.
But you did warn us at the beginning that there was more to this than meets the eye. And probably if we go digging, we'll discover what it is we also have asked you questions. It's a question of getting your fingers dirty, I guess.
Yeah. The idea is that this is taking a lot of the business processes and call routing features from typical internet world like email to the PSTN world. It's going to be interesting.
Did you say that the originating communications on the numbering range you're talking about has to originate on the PSTN?
No. The destination has to be on the internet. The origination doesn't have to. We're just talking from calls going to 780 numbers. Calls from them is a different matter. We don't care. It's just reaching somebody under that number, which is...
Well, what I'm wondering about is one of the uses for Enum is to bridge disparate SIP islands. The two SIP providers have... don't have direct IP and IP connectivity, and they're now relying on the PSTN for that connectivity. If you have to terminate PSTN, then can I presume that Austria's Enum implementation would not support bridging disparate SIP IP islands?
If we have two SIP islands using numbers within that range, of course, they could go to the PSTN, but if I'm doing the SIP proxy implementation of one of those SIP providers and I see a call to +43780, I know it's an IP destination, so I just go direct over there.
Right, but you only are aware of the information that's in your SIP provider's service platform and profile.
That's
the problem today, and what Enum hopes to solve is Enum will provide a global directory of addresses, SIP URIs, so that people can discover that this number actually will terminate IP.
Okay.
So will that still work in your numbering range?
Sure. For example, if you take in some German one-on-one voice IP service, which as far as I know does do Enum lookups on call-out, it will directly interconnect to all Austrian 780 numbers. And one of the things which we experienced is that, as Jim mentioned before, right now it doesn't make sense to do Enum lookups on all outgoing calls because there is so little chance of actually hitting somebody within Enum domain. But for 780 in Austria, you know you're going to hit one.
Okay, I'm just trying to apply some simple logic here. You said that the calls have to terminate PSTN.
No.
They have to originate PSTN.
No.
Something has to happen on the PSTN, you said. What was it?
You have to terminate calls somehow. You can either go to the block owner via this gateway, or you can go directly via IP. But it's your choice.
Neil O'Reilly, I think I may be able either to add or dissipate some confusion here. I'm not sure which I'm going to be successful in. I think one of the things you mentioned at the beginning of your first talk, Otmar, was that there were a few enough Enum-aware applications out there. One of the side effects of this is that you type in an E164 number towards your SIP provider, and the SIP provider doesn't have that part, or somehow has only selectively implemented his Enum awareness. And so there are islands of SIP reachable destinations which aren't reachable through all SIP providers. And I think this is what Robert was getting at. I've had that, for example, if I pass my desk phone number to the people at iptel.org, I'm told we don't do bridging. If I pass my E164 desk phone number from my office to Daniel Karenberg's hobby asterisk box, my Cisco phone rings. Now, that's the island's problem. Now, I don't know why it arises, but it does arise. But certainly the situation which you're describing is different, because here you have numbers which are required to be terminated only on the global internet, So they can't be in different islands. So they must know about each other, even if they're with different SIP providers.
Yeah. Okay. If the originating SIP provider does do the enum lookup, then he will terminate directly via IP. If he doesn't do that and pass the call to the PSTN, it will go to Austria. In Austria, there is the routing to the preferred gateway, whatever, which then will do the enum lookup and call. So in both cases, the call will get on my IP phone, because there is no PSTN phone for 780. Okay. Any more questions?
No.
Okay, thanks very much, Otmar. Next up, we have a report on Plus 46, the Swedish enum situation from Joachim Strålmark of the Swedish PTS.
Good afternoon, everybody. Hope you enjoy your weekend here in Stockholm. I should do a presentation of the status of enum in Sweden. First, it's about us and what is enum. Everybody here knows the enum trial in Sweden, about entities, some tricky questions and choices to be made, and our proposal in a final report to the government that we produced this Christmas, and the next step in Sweden. I'm working at the National Regulatory Authorities, which is like an administration under the government, so we are the regulator, like Ofcom in UK and FCC in United States. And enum, I guess you, everybody here knows what it is, and we understand it also that it is an associated facility according to a framework directive in the European Commission, that it is a function needed to provide services. So there we find it in the regulatory area. And it could be used for IP telephony, SIP-based telephony, and move routing from PSTN to IP network, and for IP-based PIB access, etc. And there's a lot of flavors, user enum, private enum, enterprise enum, carrier enum, operator enum, infrastructure enum, etc., etc. So we have a mixture of that in our trial in Sweden, I guess. The background, we at the regulatory office, we worked since it's in year 2000. We attended mostly ITU and ETSI, sort of the other side of this standardization group. Also been ITF once, and the CPT is a regulators club, and been a RIPE, and ONP and COCOM is a European Commission working group about things. So I've been in most of these places, but mostly on the telephone side. And we produced four reports to our government. The first one was in 2001 when enum was pretty new. And we thought we could wait for permanent introduction, but do a national trial was the conclusion of that report. Then the ministry requested us to do a trial with the parties who were interested in that. And we did a report in 2003, suggested a little more continuation of the trial. The technology works, but we need some more administrative procedures to work. Then we did an interim report, the international update, and then we did a final report this Christmas, and we think that the permanent introduction could facilitate technology development, which would improve competition between various stakeholders for the benefit of the end users. And if it don't do that, it will be nothing of it. But we think it's important to continue with a more permanent status and ending the trial now. And the trial, we had some pre-study groups, and the trial started December 2002. And the CCTLD registry, the NIC-SE, was also the enum T1 registry. We have a contract with them. There were not so many registrations, around 30, but there were many DDI PBXs. University of Stockholm was a large trial user. And during this last year, that was the industry group produced all the procedures that they reported to the NRA, how it should be working. And the industrial fora was formed in December 2004. They call it the enum forum that they do in most parts of the world. And here is a picture of sort of the entities for enum. The three boxes on the top is sort of outside the country. It's a TSB office at the ITU, the tier one tier zero managers, that is the Internet Architecture Board and the RIPE NCC people who are running the registry on the level. And then the Enum tier one manager we see is the one who sort of has the right to open the water tap for Enum in a country. And that is, as we see, the member state who have been delegated the country code 46 for telephony services. And the RFC says that it should be delegated to the same entity having these country codes. It must be the state, then, the ITU member state, we call them. And then under that, we have the tier one registry, the registrars, operators, and the bottom, the subscriber who pays all these things. For this, we have some tricky questions because we see that the state might be involved to do the delegation, otherwise there would be no delegation. So the state must do some action, otherwise nothing would happen with Enum in a country. That is based on the IB and the ITU rules. And if we push that button, we have some sort of operation responsibility for the function in the network. And we see that as a consequence when we request a delegation and the way DNS works today. So the state would be responsible for the master zone file. Today, normally, the state only have responsibility for numbering plans, and that doesn't mean the practical routing plans. That is the operator's business. And this Enum, will it be in E164 ARPA? I think that is sort of a question that is not so tricky anymore. So in the report to the government, there is some choices to be made. And I think the first choice is who should be the Enum T1 manager, the one that is responsible for everything, and the method to designate the registry, and then who could be the Enum registrars if there need to be Enum registrars, and methods for validation that Austria talked a lot about, subscriber choices, and the numbers suitable for Enum. This is about prepaid cards for mobile and the unlisted numbers and the framework for the regulation. This is what we reported to the government, and I talk about it here. Who should be the manager? The Enum T1 manager sets the rules for the Enum framework and also can designate the registry. It could be the regulator, like in Austria. It could be the government, another authority, a company, organization, etc. And we recommended it to be the government. That is the default manager to still be the manager here in Sweden, because a regulator should not have operation functions. There's an old European Commission directive to split, the old PTTs that was both regulators and operators and everything. So regulation is one thing and operation is one thing. So we think it's not good to be the regulator to be the manager. So therefore we recommended the government to be the manager, because they can do anything. They run trains, airline companies, they own parts of Telia Sonera and everything. So they can do a lot of things. So we recommended the government to be the tier one manager. And how should they designate the tier one registry? And we think it should be sort of a procurement process with a service concession. And in this concession contract, they can sort of regulate the things so they ensure that the registry do their business good and don't abuse its position. And the registry will not get any money. They have to earn it on the registrations from the subscribers and registrars. And who can act as the Enum registrars, the one who sort of registers the domain names? And we think it should be any entity accepting the requirements in the contract between the Tier 1 registry and the registrar. And these requirements might be included in the concession contract between the manager and the registry. This industry working group in Sweden suggested that only telephone service providers who has the E164 number should be the Enum registrars, but not all agree to that. But there was a small battle about that. And our competition authority disliked that recommendation from the industry. So we choose that anybody could be the Enum registrar who sort of fulfill the requirements. Methods for validation, I think this is an interesting area, but we think it could be, if it is a telephone operator, of course it's more easier because I have the subscriber from the beginning, but we think there could be other methods, shows a subscriber contract, invoices, Enum registrar can also check with the telephone service provider if they are nice. Enum registrars can check with directory companies, we have a couple of them in Sweden, and other things. And we also thought we have something called authorization directive. And that directive says very clearly what requirements you could put on a telephone operator. And we think that it could be hard to sell to the operator, you must be involved in the validation by regulation. That could be a problem with that article. But I checked it with the European Commission, and they said we can answer it if you send in a question on it to see how far the directive goes. We haven't done that yet, but that is a way of checking it. That could be also be one idea why Austria didn't want to put in some regulation in that area. And the industry fora called the Inum Forum will continue work with the detailed procedures for validation. So we're sort of having a little topic to do there. Subscriber's choice. We think it should be important that subscribers should make a choice of DNS operator, who should be the application service provider, etc. Because if it's only the telephone service provider is the registrar, it might be a problem that they might not choose DNS operators, etc. freely. But of course, opt-in procedures shall be used. In an E164 number suitable, we see the normal present geographic mobile free phone shared cost and personal numbers could be used, but not mass calling, paging, maybe dying service, premium rate, and other special routing numbers. And of course, not for non-E164 numbers. That means because the RFC is only talking about E164 numbers, where there are some 1-1 services, you know, 112 and 118 and things like that. In Sweden, there was no special request for a special numbering resource for ENUM base, so we didn't work with that at the offices. We have introduced this last month a new location-independent service numbering series that could be used for IP telephony, etc., that also could be used for ENUM. Prepaid SIM cards. Today we have around 60% of all the mobile is prepaid, so it's pretty much. And we think it should be a possibility for them to register ENUM, but they need some special procedures because from default all the prepaid customers are known, and then there must be sort of knowing them to do the validation and things like that. We have the same problem in number portability, so there is procedures there also. This is also a topic that the ENUM Forum will work with, how this procedure will work. And unlisted numbers. During the trial, they were not allowed to be in the trial, but we think it's no problem for unlisted numbers to be using ENUM, but it must be informed very clearly what the consequences will be if they register their numbers in ENUM. And we think that that is also a procedure that the ENUM Forum should work with to find a procedure how you inform the unlisted numbers. In Sweden, it's only around 10-15% that is unlisted. There's not so many unlisted subscribers here. It's mostly criminals and strange people that have unlisted numbers here. And some people in the southern part of Sweden. And myself also. But the framework for regulation, we see the present legal regulation we don't have to change. So we don't have to change the Act to continue with this proposal. Then the concession contract between the manager and the registrar is an important sort of regulation. And then there will be some self-regulation from the ENUM Forum. They have produced one that they give to the regulator that we looked at during the final report. And they must enhance it a little bit. So there is the three parts, the present legal, the concession, and the self-regulation. So we don't have to change the Act, and that is very easy, otherwise it takes 1 year to change the Act. And the next step is that the government received the report, and they normally, as it is in Sweden, authorities do reports, and they do consultation, so it should be a consultation from the government starting very soon. And after that, the market player will say yes or no, things like that. Then there must be a choice of a Tier 1 manager, and I'm not sure if the government likes our proposal there, but they either say we do it or they said somebody else have to do it with a contract between them. And then, of course, there would be the procurement of the registry function for the manager. And I guess we need to do some smaller regulation about the ENUM domain name plane because it's closely connected to the E164 numbers. And the ENUM Forum shall enhance the self-regulation framework for the topics I talked about earlier. So this will end my report. Questions?
Good, everything is crystal clear.
All right, thank you very much. Next up we have Neil, who will present on the Irish enum status. 4 or 5 minutes.
This will be quick. I had considered just sending an email to the working group list, but I thought it was better to put together a few slides so that everybody could see where we are. Yeah. The situation is the trial has run to its planned term. It actually finished on the end of March. We haven't turned anything off. All the structures are still in place. The Tier 1 is there. The two Tier 2s are still there. Both of the Tier 2s are represented here in the room. There's a report in preparation, and it will appear soon. In fact, we're meeting next week to talk about next steps, and that's the situation. We've done one or two things which you might want to hear about as well. We've had three different number categories involved in the trial. Unlisted numbers weren't excluded, but there happened to be not any used. We had geographical once-off numbers. We had the DDI block of the university where I work, not surprisingly, because we're one of the Tier 2s. And we had some mobile numbers, and that was it. And we also, this might also be interesting to the community here, between the Tier 1 and the Tier 2, we've had three different delegation methods, or referral methods, I suppose, strictly is a better word, when there aren't any NS records in there. We've also used CNAMES and DNAMES, because this allows the Tier 2 operator to do his business in a single zone, and that's more convenient from a provisioning point of view. And that's it.
Questions? Matt Stoffberg, Telesnera. What is your standpoint on validation?
For the purpose of the trial, we developed, I think the best place to look at this is probably on our regulator's website, because I think the interim report of the trial may probably details the matrix of validation transactions that we considered and recommended. And it went from, they're not all in the top of my head at the moment, but in the case of internal university customers who wanted to register with this particular Tier 2 rather than the other one, we look in the university phone book, because there are customers both from the Tier 2 side and from the fact that our buildings and services office provides the phone numbers. For people with mobile phones and other people in the university community who were therefore eligible to come through UCD rather than MCI as the Tier 2, we used callback to verify that the person there. Callback was the main validation mechanism for the purposes of the trial. Obviously, that doesn't scale quite so well when you have a bigger deployment.
What is the situation in Ireland? Do you have various operators, telephone operators?
We've got several telephone operators. We have the usual European picture of the original Ministry of Post and Telegraphs being still there as the biggest, owning most of the telephone exchanges and owning most of the last miles. And we've a number of newer entrants to the market, some there already for maybe 10 years, maybe a bit longer, and new ones popping up more or less by the day. Disappearing probably just as quickly, but it's no different from other EU countries, I think.
Otmar Nedel here. Question about, you mentioned you're doing DNAMES and CNAMES to get the delegation into one zone on the Tier 2. What's your experience with the DNAMES? Is it supported with the usual code in SER or Asterisk?
It seems to be supported in Asterisk, because Asterisk is actually the only, from behind an Asterisk is the only place I've tried to reach my desk phone, and the entire DDI block for the university is delegated using a DNAME record.
Okay, I've written that code, but I didn't know it supports DNAME, so good to hear.
Yeah, but the thing is, I don't know whether it uses a DNAME. I don't know
whether it uses the D-name or whether it uses the synthesized on the fly C-name. I don't know which I don't know what's going on under the covers. I know that I've put the tier one has put a D-name in the tier one zone for me, and I've put in appropriate stuff. I've put in the NAPTA records in the tier two zone, and I know that I can make the call. So,
what actually happens is that your recursive name server synthesizes the CNAME.
That's its job, isn't it?
Yeah. So if the client doesn't do DNAME.
Yeah, the client, I mean, typically there have been other things that I've been using DNAME for outside of enum, and I get these horrible log messages all the time about type 39 not being understood, and so because get host by adder doesn't work in that particular glibc.
Just to follow on from what Jacob said, not all recursive name servers support or understand DNames. So if you're running old name server software, it's not going to do the CNAME synthesis. It will treat the DNAME as an unknown record type.
Oh, I don't use those kind of. Jim? You mean in the resolver, in the resolver, or in the authoritative?
Neil, there's a very, very bad feedback problem.
Is this any better?
Yeah.
A little more attenuation in the loop.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Do you mean the resolvers or the authoritatives?
The resolver servers. If there's a resolver server between the resolver server that the asterisk box is using does not understand DNAME, it will not be able to do the CNAME synthesis when it encounters a DNAME answer coming back from the authoritative server.
Yes. Okay, I've been lucky.
Okay, so there's only one more thing on the agenda, and that has to do with the management of this group. And as you might have seen on the working group mailing list, we co-chairs are proposing a swap, which was planned already from the beginning, more or less, a swap from Kim and myself that didn't have so much time to actually run this working group, instead to swap to two persons that seems to do have the time. One person you just saw, Neil O'Reilly, and we talked about him being a co-chair last time. And the other proposed co-chair is Karsten Scheifner, and him and Karsten being the main contact for RIPNCC. So is there anyone that have any questions about doing this swap or any objections or anything? I have not seen any objections to me privately and not on the mail list. No objections in the room.
One question, is Carsten still at RIPE? As far as I know, he left.
No, he left and he started a new employee Monday this week, and this is one of the reasons that he say that he will be able to actually work on this. Not because of RIPE, but in the interim period from him on his way leaving RIPE and starting as a new employee, he didn't want to take on being a co-chair for the Enum Working Group. But now when he has an employee that actually pays his salary, he's lucky, like some of us. And the employer also supports his work with Enum. And as you've seen on the mailing list, he has been very active following and tracking all of these various kind of items. So that's the reason why he jumps on. And that's also the reason why he's not here this week. Okay, so if no one objects, I will make sure that change happens. Okay, good, thank you. The second thing is that when we started this working group, we were discussing a bit on what this working group was supposed to do. Because the ITF exists, the ITU talk about this, the ETSI works talks about this, but we had some requests to actually have something, some group where operational experience of enum deployment of various trials, operational experience, because it has to do with DNS a little bit, on the internet side, should happen here in the RIPE community. So to be able to do that, we have the working group mailing list where people can exchange information, announce where their conferences, announce when things are happening in various countries, etc. We also have this web page that Kim has been working with, where we update the status of each of country codes in the world, not only the ripe region. And for example, it was just updated with the information from Sweden that Joakim provided. So we have the mailing list, we have these physical meetings, and then we have this web page where we can exchange operational experience. So that is what we have found being the main task of this group, and so far not producing any official like ripe documents, because we have not really found any like operational best practices or anything. Anyone has any objection to continue to do that? Do you still see the need for it? So we should not kill this working group. Anyone that want to say something about this? Otherwise, we chairs will just take for granted that you think this is a good thing to continue with, and we will continue, or we do it. I asked Niel if he wanted to ask this question because he is now the chair, but he asked me, well, just continue to talk, he said, so that's why I'm doing this. And that's why I said we chairs, even though I'm not the chair anymore. Anyways, so anyone that want to say anything about this, should we just continue to run the working group like this for now? Yes. People are nodding, yes? Okay. In that case, 6 minutes, we end this meeting 6 minutes before. Oh, Jim wants to say something. Oh, please.
Two presentations for the price of one. Let's see if I find this thing. This mouse has got too many buttons. F6.
Control L.
Thank you. Soundbite version. 1 week, south of France, end of May, beginning of June. What else do you need to know? This is an activity which ETSI has started and has got funding from the European Commission's eEurope initiatives. So ETSI is the European Telecommunications Standard Institute. Essentially, it's a club for phone companies and telco equipment providers and regulators. It's based in Sofia, Antipolis, in the south of France. It's about 5-6 kilometres from Cannes, Nice, Monaco. Nice place to be that time of year. And this event is going to be for interoperability testing primarily, and it's going to start on Monday the 30th of May and run till the 3rd of June. It's open to anybody. It's not just for Europeans. It's not just for ETSI members. It's got a technical focus, so appeal to the people here. Marketing people are not welcome. There will be a public report on the outcome of the trial, but as part of taking part in this plug test event, there will be a non-disclosure agreement and a memorandum of understanding that all participants will sign. There's not going to be any public naming and shaming, and this is essentially what we're signing up to do, is that when you come along and experience that vendor A's SIP client is broken, you might learn that experience during the plug test. You're not allowed to then go out and see afterwards, after the plug test, vendor A's got some broken software. That's really what it's all about. So as I said, the coordination role has been part-funded by the EU's eEurope initiative, and that role is being shared between myself and Lawrence Conroy from Roke Manor Research, which is part of Siemens. So we've set up this test bed. The test bed is not quite yet set up, but it's almost all there. We are going to have an asterisk box running on top of some Linux thing, which will be plugged into the ETSI PBX. We'll have some ENAM clients. There'll be an 802.11 and Ethernet with virtually no firewall between that and the public internet. So you can access anything from within the ETSI plug test network that's on the public internet. And where I'm really getting involved in is in the cases of things to do with test cases of broken DNS issues. So it's a very good at misconfiguring name servers. I think this is something that I'm fairly good at doing. The idea here is that we want to try and instrument the behaviour for enum aware clients, be these SIP servers or phones, whenever they encounter strange things. And the sort of strange things we have in mind are things like lame delegations, unresolvable delegations, very long resolution chains, root lookups that are going to involve EDNS0 or perhaps EDNS0 lookups to name servers that don't support EDNS0 and perhaps don't do TCP queries either. DNSSEC is likely to put an appearance in there too. So what's going to happen to, let's say, some kind of wireless enum-aware application for, let's say, some mobile phone when it gets back a whole bunch of DNSSEC gunk that it didn't expect to ever see? We're going to have some examples of interesting NAPTER conditions, for example, non-terping NAPTERs or broken regular expressions and substitutions. We will have bad tell URIs. So we tell URIs containing things, digit strings longer than 16 digits. We have tell URIs that contain characters other than digits. We have tell URIs which are not E164 numbers. Say, for example, a local number in the PBX, a local number for the Sofia Antipolis region, a number that's within France without the country code on the front. What happens when those tell URIs that can then get presented to the enum application? What does it then do? We'll also have the cases of E164 numbers which are unreachable from the PSTN but are reachable from the internet and vice versa, as best we possibly can. So essentially this test bed of these DNS test cases and so on is really intended to go for SIP enum aware applications and services. That's the prime focus of it in this particular instance. We're also going to have a standard SIP client. And that standard SIP client can then be used for people to test against their own SIP server implementations. The SIP client should be released into the public domain. All the test cases in terms of the name server configurations and DNS data will be in the public domain too. But the test bed will not be in existence after the plug test completes. So there's a network of 8 name servers, some PCs down in Sofia Antipolis just now, plus this Linux server. But that infrastructure will be torn down once the plug test has completed. So what we hope to do is get aware of people, for vendors in particular, find if their stuff interoperates, and if so, what happens with these various failure modes, how those clients then behave, what happens when a client gets a serve failure back from the DNS when it does an ENM lookup, what happens if it gets back a NAPTA record which is in for 2915 RFC syntax rather than later syntax for the NAPTA records. Just study these failure modes and actually document what they are. Try and come up with some ideas perhaps on requirements, best common practices, usual motherhood and apple pie, stuff like that. And perhaps if there's enough interest out of this, perhaps this then becomes a regular event, say once a year or so. And maybe we might even find some ideas of work items that could be passed to standard making bodies such as ETSI or the IETF, or perhaps it could be also something that could be chopped to this particular working group for their consideration. Once this trial is over, a public report will be published that will be put in the public domain, which is essentially going to summarise what happens, but again, there's not going to be any naming and shaming. So if you want more information, there's some details on the ETSI website just now. There's some flyers that are sitting out by the registration desk if you want to pick up some information there. There's a couple of mailing lists, and you can also ask me as well. There's a detailed information on the test plan. It was circulated to ETSI earlier on this week. I sent it to them on Monday, but it hasn't yet made it to the website. What we will also be doing is we'll be using numbers from the UK, using numbers from Austria, some of the 780 numbers that Otmar was mentioning earlier on today, and I'm hopeful we're going to get the delegation for the ETSI DDI block in the French public enum tree. That discussion is still ongoing at the moment, but hopefully we'll have all those numbers available for actual testing, and we'll have numbers set aside to do things like, if you do a lookup of this particular number in France or in the UK, you'll get a SERF fail error, or you'll get DNS gunk back. But that information will only be provided to people who turn up at the ETSI for the plug test itself. Questions?
Yes, please. If I project, do I need the microphone?
Probably not.
Fine. Do you need any more numbers?
All's well.
You warned me about that.
Yes.
Yeah, fine. Thank you. I'll see if there's any interest.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Unless anyone has anything else they want to bring to the meeting, I think that's the end. Pretty much on time. Thanks to all the speakers.
the matrix we get.